Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Lynn Waters.
It's Monday, July 22nd from HPR2. It's The Conversation. Are Hawaii's Democrats trying to slam the door on the independent voter?
Is she just dizzy or dizzy like a fox? Either way, she's legally blonde.
Building a bridge to peace after the shooting has stopped.
Singing from a deep, deep well of emotion.
Plus, the worldview from Al Jazeera, a backyard quiz, and South Pacific Island issues in today's reality check.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Lynn Waters.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Should you be allowed to vote in a primary election only if you are a registered member of the candidate's party? Or should all such elections be so-called open primaries? You'll hear strong opinions on both sides. Hawaii's Democrats have filed a lawsuit to close their primaries, and a national organization of independent voters, independentvoting.org, wants to stop them. Jacqueline Salet is the president of independentvoting.org, and she joins us by phone. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good. Let's talk about the reasons why a state party would want to close its primary. And it would seem to me that you know, the argument would be something along the lines of, I want people who are ideologically aligned with me to vote in that primary and keep it to that. Is that kind of the argument?
That is one of the arguments that we hear on this front. And by the way, I would share with your listeners that this pattern of moving to try to close primaries is happening in a number of different places around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But this, in Hawaii, actually, this is the first time that the Democratic Party is taking this initiative. Previously, and over the last several years, it's been the Republican Party that's done it.
Yeah.
And yes, you're right. It's about enforcing a certain kind of ideological stance.
Purity.
And also giving greater control over nominations to the party machine.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some of the other arguments? I mean, that to me would be the primary one, but are there some others that are advanced, you know, to support this idea?
There are arguments made, and many of them are legal arguments that have to do with the constitutional right to freedom of association as a private organization and so forth, and the parties have claimed in court, and that will certainly be the case in this situation. With the Hawaii Democratic Party, that this is a protected organization under the Constitution and under the First Amendment. The mitigating factors, though, which are very interesting and which have been, you know, the subject of huge debate, and you're quite right, this issue is very, very controversial, not just in Hawaii, but all over the country,
mm-hmm.
Is number one, just the fact of the changing character of the electorate. 40% of the country today identifies themselves as independents, and that's largely because they don't want to be categorized or controlled by a political party. They think the parties have actually been responsible for inciting partisanship and division, and they don't want to support that. So you have a huge swath of the electorate.
And those people would be excluded, Jackie, right?
Yes, under a closed primary system, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a huge swath of the electorate which is trying to push a change in the political culture in the direction of greater collaboration, greater coalition building, and greater opportunity for all voters, no matter what their party affiliation may or may not be. And so this pushes back against that.
Well, Jackie,
issue, by the way, just to mention, is that in claiming the private right of First Amendment protection, the parties are essentially saying, well, we're private organizations and we are, you know, protected under the Constitution in terms of being able to do that.
Really?
The problem is that they're also publicly funded in terms of the primaries and in terms of, you know, gathering voter data and all of that. So I think one thing that's being said in response is, well, you know, you can't have it both ways.
Well, Jackie, I would think that the private organization argument would be pretty hard to make, but this thing about party system inciting partisanship, let me just be a devil's advocate and say, isn't partisanship what it's all about? We have one platform, the other party has another, and we seem to be losing sight of what each party's platform is, and shouldn't people who are in general in support of that platform be allowed to make decisions about how that platform is advanced?
I think that is a fundamentally correct and appropriate argument. The problem comes in, Chris, when there's a conflation between the role of the party and the role of the government or the conduct of the elections themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There are systems that are in existence that have been, you know, driven by this popular, you know, move towards political independence where there are public primaries and the parties can participate in that and field candidates as part of that, and they can have a platform and they can demand and require that people subscribe to that platform in order to, you know, be the officially endorsed candidate of the party. That is all possible and protected under the Constitution.
That's not threatened by this?
No, not at all. But
okay.
When parties try to simultaneously act as private organizations and essentially as quasi-governmental organizations, which is the case in so many situations.
That's an important distinction, isn't it, Jack?
Exactly. Very important.
Well, given that, what's your next move? What kind of response are you expecting from your open letter, your petition?
Well, a number of things. We ran our ad, and we've received dozens of phone calls and emails from a broad cross-section of people, and by the way, many of whom who've reached out to us are rank-and-file Democrats who feel very strongly that they don't want the party to make this move, to sort of, lock down on ideology and relinquish the capacity to build broader coalitions and also to influence larger segments of the population. So we're reaching out and gathering signatures for the letter, which will be formally delivered to the Democratic Party at the end of this month. We also, if you saw the ad, we also make a direct statement and an appeal to President Obama, because President Obama was actually the beneficiary of the open primary system going back to 2008, when a very powerful coalition of independents and Democrats came together, first to give him the nomination and to upend, you know, the old dynasty within the party, and then...
Because he was not the party's anointed one, right?
He was not, and actually we've done a very detailed study and were very involved in the 2008 effort, and it's very clear that if the primaries and caucuses had been closed in 2008, that Barack Obama would not have been the Democratic Party nominee, that Hillary Clinton would have been the Democratic Party nominee.
Well, that's an argument right there, Jackie, and I wish we had more time, but thanks very much for talking with us about
that. Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be hearing more about this, I'm sure. Jacqueline Salet is the president of IndependentVoting.org, a strategy and organizing center for independence with chapters in 40 states. Her organization has circulated an open letter to the people of Hawaii with an accompanying petition with the goal of keeping Hawaii's primary elections open to voters of all political persuasions. And you can learn more on our HPR2.org website. This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, an Army unit with a proud tradition builds a bridge to peace.
Unihoa, olehua, unihau. ukawa uahu umulokai ulanai umau ukahoolave uhangai.
In today's backyard, we're looking for one of the oldest existing buildings in downtown Honolulu. This historic building also happens to be the oldest Catholic church in continuous use in the United States. The cathedral was built for the Congregation of the Sacred Hearts of Jesus and Mary from Paris, France. The church was completed and dedicated in 1843. The white coral blocks used in construction came from the same reef as the coral for Kawaihao Church. In 1864, Catholic faithful gathered here for the ordination of then Father Damien. Today, the cathedral houses the cathedral or bishop's seat of the Honolulu Diocese. For today's quiz, can you tell us which cathedral we're talking about? We'll proclaim the answer from the humble HPR Cathedra later in the show.
Every Monday, we like to check the conversation and the caffeine pulse around Oahu. Today, Bill Sage is at Tango Contemporary Cafe. Good morning, Bill. What you got going down there?
Good morning, Chris. Well, right now we have three people at Tango who have things which are much on their mind. First of all, we'd like to speak with Jim about residents along the rail. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I'm Jim Schlosser, and I was part of a group representing every condominium here in Kaka'ako. And we had band together because we were concerned about the DEIS of the rail project. We were not against the rail per se, but we were certainly against the way it was planned. And we're hoping that the court case will find that the current plans for the rail will not be able to go on as it exists.
So what started out as a fairly quiet thing is now becoming steel on steel, and the noise footprint alone is one of the reasons for concern?
Exactly. Actually, the building I live in, the rail should come 70 feet away from somebody's bedroom. That doesn't make sense. And another 100 feet from another building.
Thank you very much, Jim. Well, that's one thing to think about, all you people wondering about rail and steel on steel. Susan is also here, and Susan is a Kaka'ako resident. You're saying the homeless problem is something that concerns you greatly.
Yes, my family's been in Hawaii five generations now. I'm a former Department of Education public school teacher, and I have seen the growth in the number of homeless people in this Ala Moana Beach Park and Kaka'ako area, and I'm very concerned. I'd like the state to address that.
What do you think they could do to solve the problem, if anything?
Well, I understand it has to be a multiple-prong approach, not just providing them, physical shelter, but also to help them medically and socially, emotionally, and it just has to be a multiple-prong approach that our state needs to look at.
Some of these people are chronically mentally ill, and some are just down on their luck, but in the multi-prong approach, do you think it's possible to actually get it solved?
I think it's possible. We just, again, have to look deeper and broader.
Okay, thank you very much, Susan. And also, we have with us Ryan in Kaka'ako. And Ryan, Kaka'ako started out as a fairly low-rise area, but now things are getting higher, at least in building elevation. So that's one of your major concerns?
Yes, good morning. One of the major concerns is the development going on in and around the Kaka'ako area. Some are for it, some are against it. We have Waihonua coming on the backside here by Hawaiki Tower, as well as Ala Moana Center, and then numerous other developments here in and around the ward in Kaka'ako area. Many condos coming up, Howard Hughes, and whatnot.
So what is the highest, what's the height allowance is going to be stretched for Kaka'ako? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, we have a lot of concerns from residents in my building as well as others, as far as the infrastructure, schools, sewer systems, and, directly related with that homeless concern, and the rail. I think they all go hand in hand in this area here.
Now, what is the overall, we always hear about water main. Have they finally fixed the infrastructure beneath the streets?
They're working on it from what we understand with city and county. I would highly recommend everyone and encourage everyone to come out to neighborhood board meetings over at the church here on Pensacola and hear and see what's really going on and give your opinions.
Okay, do you think that Kaka'ako could support many more high-rises? You think it's pretty much reaching max?
Well, for me, it seems to be maxing out, but we'll see, and we'll see what everybody has planned.
Okay, mahalo. Thank you very much, Ryan. That is what is actually on the minds of people brewing in the Kaka'ako area here at Tango. It's been a lively crowd. The caffeine itself is wonderful, and next week we'll be sipping another cup of coffee somewhere around the island. So, Chris, enjoy your morning cup, and we'll see you next week.
It's a send-up of the ditzy blonde stereotype that was an immediate hit with audiences when it came out as a movie. Legally Blonde, the story of the fashion-obsessed young woman who turns Harvard Law School on its head, is an ideal plot for a light and frothy stage musical. Diamondhead Theater's production has just begun its run, and the director, Andrew Sakaguchi, is with us this morning. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Thank you for giving up your first morning to sleep in late, as you told me before the show. It's good to have you with us. So what appealed to you about this production, taking it on as a director?
Well, first of all, I'm really thrilled to have an opportunity to work with my longtime friend, Christine Yasunaga, who's the choreographer of the production. We've been friends since high school and have both had careers on the stage in New York. She called me when the opening came up to direct the show, and I was happy to jump right in. I think it's a fantastic story. It's a lively show with tons of energy and terrific dance numbers, and it's great to be a part of it.
You were telling me that the majority of the cast, or at least half of them, are young people, right? They're still not only in college, but also even in high school.
It's true. Half of them are still in high school, of the ensemble are still in high school, and many of the others are just home on summer break from college, and they are all fantastic, fantastically talented, hugely energetic, and many of them I've seen grow up on the stage since they were small children. So it's really exciting to be working with them. They keep me young.
Now, I have to admit, I didn't know there was a musical version of this. I know the movie well. I've seen it several times. What would appeal to somebody who liked the movie but didn't know about the musical? How would you entice them to come see the production?
Well, I would say that, you know, the great thing about musical theater is that we're able to appeal to a broader audience because there's a wider range of things that are exciting, be it an energetic dance number or a powerful romantic ballad. We can appeal to the different, you know, emotional connections that people have to their theatrical experience.
Tell me about some of the characters and the cast members that are playing them. Who plays the lead?
The lead is a young woman named Jody Bill. She is a force of nature. She's a dynamo. She's tiny, but with this huge voice. And she is on stage for almost all of the 2 hours and 15 minutes of the show. If she's not on stage, she's off stage changing costume, ready to run back out and dance or belt out another number. And you can't believe that voice lasts for the whole show, let alone for, you know, five performances a week.
So it's a demanding role for the
absolutely.
Lead character. Because as I think back to the movie, that character was in almost every scene.
It's true. She really carries the whole show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there other local cast members whose names we would recognize?
I'm so fortunate that Larry Paxton has mm-hmm. been interested enough to be in the show, and he plays the law professor Callahan, who starts out as the representative of the ideals of law and ends up kind of smarmy. Larry has embraced the role. And also the incredibly gifted Megan Mount is playing the hairdresser Paulette. So it's a decidedly lowbrow turn for Megan as she's, you know, an operatic singer. But yeah.
She's indulging her common side.
Absolutely, and she's living it up.
We're talking about Diamondhead Theater's production of the musical Legally Blonde, directed by Andrew Sakaguchi. And you yourself are a local guy, but you live in New York now?
I do, yeah. I've been back in New York for about 5 years.
What do you do with your time up there?
I work for National Dance Institute, which is a nonprofit. It was founded by ballet dancer Jacques d'Amboise he retired from City Ballet. Mm-hmm. And we work in partnership with about 40 different public schools in the city, bringing dance education to students there, fourth and fifth graders mostly.
Oh, so that must be fun and rewarding.
It is. It's really, I'm the luckiest guy because I get to do that.
Now, when you come back here to Honolulu from New York, which is, of course, the mecca of theater production, do you see enough good talent here locally to have a vibrant theater community?
Absolutely. What's so exciting here is not only that the talent is there, but there is a different kind of passion in the local actors and dancers and singers. There's a different kind of drive that it's hard to pinpoint, but it's a hunger for it, and I think it's from being so far removed from the professional big lights, that they see it. They see it on television. They see it on the internet now that the world has gotten so much smaller, and they really apply themselves to their craft and to what they bring to the stage. So what we have here is really on a level on par with anything else that you'd see, or greater than what you'd see in many parts of the country.
If there is a young person out there listening who maybe has a dream of doing what you've done or pursuing a career on the stage, what advice would you give them?
I would say never stop working. And I say that because when I was young, I met Mary Martin. She was at Liberty House signing pictures, and I went to see her, and that was the advice she gave me.
Oh.
And, I've never stopped working either since then.
Great story.
Thanks.
So you're passing it on.
Mm.
So Diamond Head Theater's production of the musical Legally Blonde is running, and what else would you like to leave our audience with before we bid you aloha this morning?
Well, I would be greatly remiss if I didn't mention that the most amazing little white Pomeranian, Bobby Gorgeous.
Oh, that's right. There was a pivotal dog character.
Yeah, he is incredible. So if for no other reason, get on down to check Bobby Gorgeous out because he steals the show.
Bobby Gorgeous, that's his name?
That's his name.
Is that how he's billed in the playbill?
Absolutely. And this is his motto: love, life, be gorgeous.
And on that note,
we
will thank Andrew Sakaguchi for joining us this morning. He is the director of Legally Blonde, the musical at Diamond Head Theater, running until August 11th. You can find out more about it at hpr2.org.
What you want, Warner, what you want is me. But you need to see me in a brand new domain. Well, it's plain, Warner, in a different setting. You will see you're getting all of this plus a brain. I'll meet you there in Harvard with a book in my hand. Big sturdy book, big wordy book, full of words I'll understand and write. There is where you'll see it too. Warner, what you want is right in front of you.
What you want
is clear.
What you want
right here.
What you want is right in front of you. Front of you. What you want
is clear.
What you want
right here.
What you want is right in front of you.
You don't have to apply to get this job, and you basically can't get fired. Those are perhaps the only benefits of being a caregiver in the USA.
His caregiving is really a full-time job. Feels like I've been waging a war for 20 years.
The challenges of caregiving next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio listeners who are also station members are truly partners in this independent, locally operated enterprise. We gratefully acknowledge Elizabeth Thompson of Honolulu, Bobby Joe Curley of Kihei, and Forrest Frizzell of Kailua for their recent membership gifts. New members most often join at the $10 a month True Believer level, and as more listeners become members, the station grows even stronger. You can become an HPR member today at hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:27. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
The United States has a special obligation to its Micronesian population, born out of the troubling after effects of nuclear testing conducted in Micronesian waters in the 1950s. The U.S. Compact of Free Association gives citizens of these island nations the right to live and work here, but assimilation into American society is something no law can guarantee. And Chad Blair is here with today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris, and well said. A very nice introduction to today's reality check.
Well, thank you. Does the average American citizen understand what the Compact of Free Association is all about?
No, and I would say actually most folks in Hawaii don't, even though there's a direct impact. I mean, in short, it was an agreement, 1986, between the United States and three Micronesian nations. And under that agreement, Micronesians are allowed to travel, live here, and work here, in part, as you indicated, the obligation that we have toward them because of the nuclear testing.
You know, one thing I didn't realize until recently, Chad, was that one of the reasons we tested thermonuclear devices, and there were more than 60 tests in the South Pacific in the early 50s, one of the reasons we tested them in the South Pacific was that they were vastly more powerful than the ones that we tested in Nevada and at Alamogordo, right?
That's right. These are the hydrogen bomb tests, not the atomic bomb test. Considerably more. I'm not sure what the measurement is. Is it megatonnage? I'm not even sure if you can say
way more than Hiroshima.
They really are. And you know, my interest in this is personal. I grew up in Kwajalein, which is in the Marshall Islands, one of those three island nations that belong to the compact. And we were actually out there in the 60s. I graduated from high school out there in the 1970s. So I have a personal interest in what has happened to the people out there. I was lucky enough to speak with Father Fran Hezel. He was in town last week. He's got a new book out. It's from UH Press. And a new report from East-West Center. It's this twofer. And he does an amazing job of explaining why the history of Micronesia is so important and why it's so important for us to understand why they're coming to the Hawaii and to the United States.
And yet there's some real cultural gaps to be bridged, aren't there?
It's a big deal, and I don't have enough time to go into it, but I'll just say just quickly, Father Hezel encouraged us to accept Micronesians as the latest immigrant group here. Read his book, understand where they came from. Finally, let's get the federal government to help cover those medical expenses that they're incurring and burdening our system here in the islands.
It's quite a powerful story. Thanks very much,
yes,
Chad.
It is.
Chad
welcome,
Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, I understand tonight you're talking about something that unfortunately all too many of us are familiar with, and that is chronic pain.
That's what's on the show today. We're going to talk about some new interventions that can really help so that people don't just have to live with chronic pain, because in a lot of cases, you know, it really can be disabling.
So I understand that maybe the medical profession is starting to look at this issue a little bit differently than from how they've traditionally handled it?
Well, it's a difficult thing because on the one hand, we want to give pain relief. So there's a lot of strong pain pills out there. A lot of those are highly addictive, and they also require ever-increasing doses to get the same effect. So pharmaceutical companies have developed other types of medications to treat pain, and we've also gotten better at some of the techniques of what we call interventional pain treatment. So we're talking about even surgically implanting pain pumps and things like that that can really help to resolve the pain as much as possible, much better than just taking a lot of tablets will.
For our listeners out there who may not be sure that they qualify for this, how would you explain or define chronic pain real briefly?
Well, that's kind of a subjective thing. Chronic pain, when you have pain at least, you know, more than half the week and it affects something that you do every day. So we talk about it affecting daily functioning. So if you have pain, it could be someone with arthritis pain, and now they limit their lifestyle in order to accommodate for that pain, and it affects them more than half the week and more than 3 or 4 weeks at a time. So a lot of people may not realize that they fit this category, and we're going to talk some more about what this really means, who we're talking about, and what are some of the interventions that have come out recently that can really help people to do well and get back to their usual state of living as much as possible.
New approaches to chronic pain management tonight on The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak at 5.
Aloha. Good morning. My name is Liz Nelson. I'm recently retired from St. Francis Hospice as a nurse, and you're listening to a conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering private banking, trust administration, and financial management services to help individuals and families reach their financial goals. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
This is The Conversation on HPR 2. Later in the show, The Passions of the Portuguese Soul. No one hates war and loves peace more than a warrior. The closer you've been to conflict, the more you're likely to value serenity and just plain human kindness. The Wolfhounds, the Hawaii-based U.S. Army 27th Infantry Regiment, based at Schofield Barracks, value their traditions as one of the Army's most decorated combat units. They also have a deep connection to a tradition established after the fighting stopped. Dan Wilson is a retired Lieutenant Colonel and Wolfhound, who's with us this morning to tell us about the Peace Bridge and his unit's unique relationship with the faraway orphanage. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Chris.
This project, which is the Wolfhounds have since the years after the Second World War supported an orphanage that they came across in Japan during the post-war occupation of Japan, yeah?
Yeah, it's an incredible story. I'm very happy to be here today to talk to you about it and to share it with your listeners. It's really the story of a group of American soldiers who fell in love with a group of destitute Japanese orphans after a very, very bitter and racist war. And the fact that they've continued this relationship for almost 65 years is just incredible. But then the third part of that is that this is growing into more than just about the Wolfhounds and the Holy Family Home. It's becoming a story of aloha, and that it's growing into more than that. It's growing into a Hawaiian thing.
Let's talk about the seeds of it for a second, Dan. Essentially, the Wolfhounds saw the faces of these young kids in a war-ravaged nation.
Yeah, it was very similar to what we do in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were actually directed to go out around Christmas time and do what you might call hearts and minds type things, where they look for goodwill events to take on. Mm-hmm. And so they went to this small orphanage run by some Catholic nuns. And it just went from there. I mean, it absolutely melted the hearts of the small group of guys that went, led by Sergeant Major Hugh O'Reilly. And he came back and he said, guys, we've got to help these kids out. And they turned out their pockets, and that first giving was $143. And ever since then, it's never stopped.
I'm sort of trying to put myself in the mindset of these original Wolfhounds who started the program, and we talked about this a little bit when we met earlier this morning, that mm-hmm. there's something in the mind of a warrior that yearns for innocence in the face of a child. Yeah.
Well, I think those of us that experienced war understand that we don't seek warfare, we don't glorify it. We're there to protect the weak, mm-hmm. and that this was really what this story was with these Japanese children, that these soldiers who had fought through World War II and had suffered some of the most brutal combat in history looked at these children and said, they are the innocents who deserve to be helped.
Mm-hmm. And this is a relationship that has continued ever since, started in 1949.
Absolutely. And the amazing thing is that less than 7 months after this first visit to the orphanage, of course, the North Koreans invaded South Korea, and so the regiment was alerted for deployment and soon sailed to Busan and fought in some of the most brutal fighting of the Korean War. And everybody thought that this thing would go away, most importantly, the nuns of the Holy Family Home. Mm-hmm. But even during the most vicious fighting, all of the wolfhounds would come to Hugh O'Reilly and say, what are we doing for the kids back in Japan? And so that started the tradition of passing helmets around foxholes under fire to raise money for the kids. And I think their last donation cycle in 1953, they raised the equivalent of like $15,000, and they actually built an entire wing of the orphanage in Japan.
What's the importance of that initiative to those soldiers under fire when they're doing it?
Well, I just think it keeps them connected to their humanity, and it's very easy to lose that when you're seeing your friends killed and maimed. And so like when I was in Iraq or Afghanistan, if we'd have some tough times, I always made sure to get our soldiers around children because it reminds them of their humanity and what they're fighting for.
You know, when you look at the face of somebody who's looking at a child, you see a relaxation in their facial features. You don't see any other way, do you?
No, not at all.
What's the ongoing nature of this program now?
Well, that's what I was saying. Is that this has grown into more than just about the Wolfhounds. We have a wonderful organization called Peace Bridge that has got very successful and dynamic civilian leadership from all across Hawaii. And they were touched by the story of these soldiers and these children, and they've decided to help continue this incredible legacy. So we're getting ready to welcome 4 children. We've been doing this since 1956. Every year, 4 children from Japan come here, and they spend 2 wonderful weeks, the times of their lives with Wolfhound families up on Schofield Barracks. And then through the generosity of incredible companies like the Polynesian Cultural Center, Japan Airlines, Honolulu Aquarium, the Outrigger Canoe Club, and many, many others, these kids will have 2 weeks of just the best time of their lives, and they're going to go home and never forget it.
That's, you know, so you're going well beyond. I mean, originally this is an outgrowth of unit pride.
Exactly.
in the Wolfhounds, but at the same time, there's an element of unit pride in taking it outside of the unit.
Of course. And I mean, you can't help but be touched by this story. And I think it just appeals, especially particularly here in Hawaii, to that spirit of aloha, again, of giving to others. And that's why that the appeal is so strong here and why we're continuing to grow. And we're looking at doing more for these children and looking at maybe helping them out educationally. They come from disadvantaged families. And we're looking at expanding our fundraising programs into providing college scholarships or other educational opportunities. And additionally, there's an organization here called International Child, that people can contact if they're interested in adopting children from the Holy Family Home in Japan.
You're retired now.
Yeah, just retired on May 1st.
But is this a part of your mission going forward?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I'm a member of Peace Bridge, because I want to continue. You know, they say, I have a saying, once a wolfhound, always a wolfhound. And I will never stop trying to help the children of the Holy Family Home and really children all over the world, because I've seen the worst of war all over the world, and I want to help children.
What you've seen in seeing the worst of war, that's a big part of your motivation, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you go back to my time, particularly in Afghanistan. I've got 3 deployments to Afghanistan. I've got very dear friends, and there's too many stereotypes out there in the media that need to be corrected. I mean, I see people over there, they're just like us. They want to raise a family. They want to live in peace, and they deserve our help.
Maybe we can take a step toward demolishing some of those stereotypes.
I hope so.
Dan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Dan Wilson is a retired lieutenant colonel, a 26-year U.S. Army veteran who's been a wolfhound since 2004. He now works with Peace Bridge, a nonprofit founded to carry on the legacy of the late Hugh F.X. O'Reilly and the Hawaii-based 27th Infantry Regiment of the U.S. Army, known as the Wolfhounds. You can learn more about the Peace Bridge mission on our HPR2.org website.
Train a-comin'. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealer's honing. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is Stargazer, our weekly guide of what to look for in our island skies. We're joined by Sean Lodge from the Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island, our official conduit to the research community atop Mauna Kea. Hey, Sean, aloha. What are some of the things we'll be looking for in our week of stargazing?
Aloha, Dave. Greetings from Mauna Kea. Full moon is tonight. It will rise in the east at sunset and set in the west at sunrise. Look for Venus in the western sky at sunset and Saturn in the southwestern sky at that same time. If you are a morning riser, Mars and Jupiter are about a degree apart in the eastern sky tomorrow morning. After that, the two will separate and get more space between them each day. Jupiter will be much brighter than the dimmer red Mars, but both are easy to see in the east in the morning.
Anything unusual happening over the course of the week?
Sunday is the peak of the Delta Aquarius meteor shower.
Ah.
Start watching for it in the eastern sky around 10 p.m. or so, and one can expect roughly 15 to 20 meteors per hour during the peak, which is around 1 a.m. This shower is known for its occasional persistent trails, where you'll see actually a bright streak that lingers for a few seconds in the sky, so it's worth taking a look at.
Oh, wow. And how long will it last, you think?
Typically, the meteor shower itself will last throughout that evening, but your best time around 1 a.m., as I mentioned.
Right, for the peak most activity. And what else is happening this week?
Since Mars is in the morning sky, it is worth noting that 10 years ago this month, Opportunity was launched to Mars. This is one of the pair of rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, which have taught us a great deal about the surface of that planet. These two spacecraft were designed to last 90 days, but have made continued discoveries for the last 9 years. Opportunity continues to explore the planet and has traveled more than 22 miles since landing on the red planet. While Spirit is no longer operational, it's pretty amazing the work that these two spacecraft have done.
They're powered by solar, I'm assuming?
That is correct.
Wow, that is cool. That's a long shelf life.
Definitely a long haul.
Got their money's worth for sure. Well, thank you so much, Sean. We appreciate the update.
Mahalo for having me, Dave.
You are quite welcome. Sean Lodge, Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next time here on Stargazer.
Back on Earth and in today's backyard, we asked you to give us, earlier in the show, asked you to give us the name of Hawaii's oldest Catholic cathedral. The Congregation of the Sacred Hearts of Jesus and Mary paid for its construction, which was completed in 1843, and as the first of its kind in the islands, the cathedral housed the first clock tower in the territory. Masses were played on a pipe organ installed in 1847, the first time that instrument had been found in Hawaii. And when the Diocese of Honolulu was founded in 1941, this almost 100-year-old cathedral was selected as its mother church. The cathedral's white coral exterior was excavated from the same Kaka'ako Reef as Kuaiahau Church and can be seen as you stroll through Fort Street Mall. The Cathedral of Our Lady of Peace has been here for 170 years, one of downtown's oldest structures. And that's today's backyard quiz. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Kathy Betts from the Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
One might describe fado as the music of the Portuguese soul. The word fado, spelled F-A-D-O, means fate or destiny, and the music has a deep melancholy at its heart. For Romana Vieira, it's the music of her heritage, and it's also the inspiration for what she calls fado-inspired world music. She's coming to Honolulu this weekend, and she's on the phone with us this morning from California. Good morning, Romana.
Bon dia, hola, and aloha.
Thank you so much. We're looking forward to hearing more about Fado and especially hearing your music this weekend. Tell me exactly, in your words, what is Fado?
Yes. Well, you know, it's a big question in terms of, well, you described it beautifully opening up the interview with calling it fate, destiny. I see it as the blues root music of the Portuguese.
So this is the Portuguese version of the blues, possibly.
You know, yes, it's a very cathartic style of music, much like how we experience the blues here in the United States. This is very much along those lines. It's the lamenting, emotional purging music of the Portuguese. It's very beautiful music. It's very passionately driven. And, you know, like how flamenco music is from Spain or tango from Argentina, Fado is from Portugal.
Is it usually played in a minor key to give it that sort of haunting?
You know, really, that's actually a beautiful question. You know, there's songs that have minor and major keys. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of both.
A little of both.
I would say some songs are more melancholic, while other songs are, they have some of the major keys. In fact, I think you opened with Coimbra, which has a minor and a major key happening throughout the song.
So it can be upbeat as well.
Yes.
Now, you were telling me that you grew up with this music. Tell me how you learned it and a little bit about your lineage.
You know, my mom I grew up listening to Amália Rodrigues, the famous fadista from Portugal, just like the Edith Piaf, you know, of Portugal. Amália Rodrigues is the famous, legendary woman that brought really Fado on an international, global level. Mm-hmm. So I grew up listening to Amália from my mother's prized record collections, and my mom would do her household, you know, work, peeling beans and, you know, working throughout the house with singing at the top of her lungs, this music. And so I observed this growing up and went to Portugal in my late teens on a dare to sing Fado in a typical Fado house. Well, the dare happened when I was actually in Portugal, not the trip itself. But and you know, I was asked to go, you know, sing on stage in the typical Fado house in Lisboa, and I sang one of these songs from Amália, Estranha Forma de Vida, this strange life of mine, and I brought the house down, and I thought, wow, okay, you know, maybe I'm onto something here. I was actually studying to be I was studying theater, and I was wanting to go into Broadway, and I realized that I was part of a legacy of music that I really wanted to explore, and I haven't looked back since.
So another avenue to express your creativity opened up for you.
In a very big and deep, meaningful way, absolutely, yes.
And your parents are from Portugal? Did they grow up in Portugal?
They did, yes. So I'm what I guess you would call a first-generation Portuguese-American.
Okay.
Here in the Bay Area in California.
Mm-hmm.
My parents grew up in a beautiful island called Madeira. Mm-hmm. And it's a romantic, gorgeous island off the Portuguese coast.
So you're bringing musicians with you for your performance this weekend. Tell me briefly what kinds of musical instruments will they be playing?
Well, we have a Portuguese guitarra. It's a guitarra with a double R.
Mm-hmm.
And this is indigenous of Portugal and a beautiful, it's probably the most distinctive of all the instruments there's no other guitar that sounds like it. It's a very unique sounding guitar, and so Michael McMorrow will be playing the guitarra And then the other unique component, we will be bringing cello, which has that rich, haunting, beautiful voice and texture to the music. And that will be Laura Boyce. And then we have an incredible, wonderfully engaging percussionist named Stephen LaPorta, and a bass guitar equally as animated and really, I mean, we all have a great passion, and that's Alberto Ramirez on bass. So we're all really passionate about the music, and I think that translates during our performance.
We're looking forward to hearing it, and I love the analogy of the Edith Piaf of the Portuguese world. I think that's a character that so many people can identify with and sort of understand, oh, yes, okay, I know what you're talking about here.
We're torch singers.
Yes.
We're torch singers, just like
Edith Piaf.
It's very torch music, very passionate music. We also, I mean, you can dance also. We've sort of infused some Latin rhythms and African rhythms in some of the music, so... it's definitely our own contemporary. You won't hear anybody like us. We've definitely steeped really into the roots of the music and then pulled out our own sort of contemporary approach to the music while having one foot in the tradition.
Thank you so much for giving us a glimpse of it this morning. Ramana Vieira will perform Saturday, July 27th at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater. Details at hpr2.org.
Did you know that Hawaiian music played a part in the making of the blues? Acclaimed blues guitarist Stephen George reveals these connections and more in a special evening of music and stories at the Atherton Studio, Saturday, July 27th at 7:30. His performance of country blues to more contemporary compositions is accompanied by his fascinating insights on blues history. That's Saturday, July 27th. Tickets available at hawaiipublicradio.org or call 955-8821 during business hours.
Well, Lynn, first of all, I want to thank you for sitting in for Beth Ann this
week.
My
pleasure.
It's great to have you.
It's been a great morning.
We talked earlier to a member of the Schofield-based Wolfhounds about a peace initiative that comes from some pretty hardcore warriors.
Yes, that was interesting to see the soft side of those people that we think of as being so tough and so focused and almost one-dimensional, but there are multi-dimensions to them, obviously.
Well, and there have to be, you know, multi-dimensions to all human beings. And you know, what Dan talked about was the way that the members of the Wolfhounds found a way to sort of connect to their humanity through these orphan kids in Japan, a relationship that has continued to this day and is actually expanding.
And that is remarkable that it has continued. I remember 20, 30 years ago seeing news stories of them bringing the orphans over for those annual visits and thinking, wow, what an incredible story that is.
Yeah,
it's amazing that it's continuing.
Heading on 60 years now. Good stuff. Well, that's it for today. And up tomorrow, rethinking the way we deal with homelessness in Hawaii.
Plus, young performers on Maui take on a musical that could have been about them.
Talk back to your radio. Find us and each other on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. And tweet us at HI Conversation or our executive producer, Beth Ann Kozovich, at BKOZHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Lynn Waters.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of The Conversation.